For SDPB Radio, I'm Lori Walsh, and you're listening to In the Moment. Welcome to this week's news podcast. Rosebud and the Fort Belknap Indian community sue President Donald Trump for violating treaties. South Dakota parents, educators, and health officials face a four-year gap in data about risky youth behaviors. A Sanford health researcher talks vaping. Hemp crop insurance is on the way, despite Governor Noem's opposition. The Dakota political junkies tackle the week's top headlines. South Dakota joins 14 other states in a case the U.S. Supreme Court will hear regarding discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Plus, a new human relations task force appointed in Rapid City. But first, the Interim Joint Committee on Appropriations met last week. Democratic State Representative Michael Saba is on the committee, and he joined SDPB's Steve Zwemke for a conversation about the meetings and to talk about new ways to bring revenue into South Dakota.
Let's start by talking about the purpose of last week's Interim Joint Appropriations Committee meetings.
Well, we have regular interim meetings during the off-session period around the state as a rule. In this particular case, we had it up in Brookings because we were looking at various projects that we've funded or projects that are asking for funding. So it was kind of the Brookings stop was right in the middle of going from Mitchell to Madison to Lake Norton and then over to Brookings and then to Volga and then up to Watertown where we ended it. But we had the meeting in Brookings.
Right. Let's talk about new international business for South Dakota. We spoke over the phone last week, and you shared some very interesting ideas. Let's bring that to the table now. First, though, you explained that there are two kinds of new dollars. Would you go there first?
Well, my single highest priority, Steve, is in the legislature, and the work I'm doing is to bring new business into South Dakota and to preserve and enhance South Dakota's agricultural heritage. Those are very important. And I'm tying the two together. When you say there are only two kinds of new dollars, one is when the government prints new dollars, and that puts us further in debt, $22 trillion and rising, I believe. Mm-hmm. I believe it's $1 billion a day in interest that we're paying on that debt. And when you print more money, you're creating a larger debt. Or you go outside the United States and you bring new business into the United States. Those are truly new dollars. When we steal business from Minnesota, for example, if North Dakota or South Dakota or any of the other states get a new kind of business because another state is losing it, it's just recirculating old dollars. So bringing new business can be done through bringing in dollars from outside the United States, and I'm working very hard on that.
You already gave us some examples of ways that we have some projects in place in South Dakota. As we look at international money, though, in South Dakota, what are some examples we currently have in place with foreign countries or businesses?
Well, the major example is that, generally speaking, economists will say that 70% of South Dakota's economy is based on agriculture, and 40% or more even of that agricultural business is based on exports. So right from the get-go, we are very dependent on international business. But we have very little to do with it in a direct sense. We just kind of wait for international business to come to us. And what I've been doing and what I've just recently done is decided through my experience internationally, and I've lived outside the United States for many years, and I speak various languages and travel often in my work to other countries, is to bring some of those new dollars into South Dakota directly. So recently I was on a trip about 3 weeks ago to the Middle East, to Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt. And while there, I organized, this was on my own personal basis, I organized trade delegations coming from those countries into South Dakota. The first one's coming from Egypt in October. Very importantly, those countries are purchasers of agricultural products and agri-technology. But when we hear that Egypt purchases, or was one of the 10 top purchasers of soybeans, for example, from the United States, it's out of New York or Chicago or whatever, and they don't know much about South Dakota. So it's very important to bring these trade delegations directly to South Dakota to see the quality of our products and to see if we can put some possible projects together for them that would be more direct, between the state and countries like Egypt.
We discussed tariffs, crops, and farmers. Of course, they're at the forefront of our news and now for several months. Are there ways for South Dakota to seek out and work with other markets like you're talking about, Egypt, some other countries, to lessen the effect of tariffs for those here in South Dakota?
Well, what we see with the tariffs on China is how dependent we become on one market. Mm-hmm. And that's never good to become dependent on one market because, as we've seen, when we have the tariffs being placed on China and they're coming back at us with their own tariffs, and right now they've cut off all agricultural imports from the United States, not just beans and corn and so on, but all agricultural imports. And we're seeing it on other products too. We must be looking for other markets. We should be aggressive in looking for those other markets, not just wait for them to come to us. And as a legislator that has experience in the international marketplace, I've taken it upon myself to go out to that international marketplace and bring business here. And we're having meetings this week here with the Sioux Falls Chamber of Commerce. It's going to be one of the hosts for this group of Egyptians. We're bringing in all the trade organizations, the soybeans, the corn, and the wheat organizations, as well as the cattle people, and agritechnology, because these folks are very interested in agritechnology. So they can see what we have, and chances are we'll be invited for a return delegation to go to those countries. Mm-hmm. And that's extremely important. Now, the state should be more involved in this. As a representative of the people, though, as a state representative of the people, I'm taking it upon myself to represent those people in a direct sense, not wait for the state to put these trade delegations together. We haven't had trade delegations for years now from South Dakota. And part of it is we just are sitting here and kind of waiting for business to come to us. President Trump was asked in Kansas some few months ago by a farmer about the tariffs. And he said, look, I'll take care of the nation, you take care of your states. So that's what we should be doing, taking care of our own state. That's what I'm doing.
Hmm. I'm curious about that, too, because if South Dakota is not doing enough in that area, I'm curious to know, with your meetings last week with the rest of the Joint Appropriations Committee, how much did you talk about what you're talking with me about right now? And where does the rest of the committee and the rest of the legislature stand?
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that we have a balanced state budget, and we have had since the inception of statehood. And that's part of my responsibility on the Appropriations Committee to ensure that. But it also seems to me that particularly with appropriations, we should be looking for more money to come into the budget mm-hmm. so that we can expand our state's needs. And that's basically what I talked about at the Appropriations Committee, how I'm doing that. I asked them to join my efforts to increase this business coming into the state. And interestingly, in many of the places we stopped, we found that there probably is more international business going on already by the efforts of individual companies. Sure. Like, for example, in Watertown, we discovered that Tessera company, that's a large company up there, manufacturing company, is already on all seven continents. It's on Antarctica as well as the other six, for example, with their wares. And the Lake Area Technical Center up there has been training aviation technicians from Indonesia. Now, interestingly, Indonesia is also a major purchaser of soybeans, generally, U.S. soybeans. We should have those Indonesians over here looking at our beans and saying, come on, we've got the best beans in the country. We've got the best corn in the country. We've got the best beef in the country. Come and buy it from us directly. We've got people that can sell it to you. That needs to happen in a very aggressive sense. We can't just wait. We can't be complaining about the tariffs without doing something on our own.
That leads me into the next question, too. You're talking about some of the efforts of our trade schools here in South Dakota, and we have some really excellent trade schools or technical schools that work in very specific areas, places like Mitchell Tech, for example. How do we incorporate some of our technical schools into helping gain international dollars for the state of South Dakota?
Well, basically, there's a lot of jobs that can lead to that. For example, most of the schools now, and primarily South Dakota State, is developing precision agriculture. We're the only, I believe North Dakota now has adopted a precision agriculture program, but we're the first state, and we have the only extensive program in four-year program degree in precision agriculture, which helps increase and allocate much better planning to increasing crop production, for example. That can be sold, and the technicians that deliver that can be trained here to do that. That's badly needed in the rest of the world, not just here. We can be selling that technology. We can be having our people. I was reading in the Argus Leader this morning about the brain drain, and one of the quotations about in that article was, I'm leaving the state after I'm educated here because we don't have the diversity here that I like to see. We don't have the ability to see the world. Well, we can do that with training people in these kinds of technical jobs that can go out of the state, can be in the state, can live here in South Dakota, can be going and doing technological consulting in countries all over the world. So we can be doing that with our training institutions.
A lot of times it seems, when you talk about that, a lot of times it seems like South Dakota is still kind of an untapped resource. I mean, we that are here in South Dakota really realize the potential and some of the things we have going for us, especially when you look at the medical field. Do you kind of see it that way too, that we're still untapped as opposed to some of the other parts of the country?
Absolutely. The last few years I've worked for both the Sanford and the Avera Health Systems. They've got world-class things going on. I was responsible for putting the children's clinics around the world for Sanford. I moved them into, helped move them into China and to Ghana, for example. And then when I moved over to Avera, I worked with them with precision medicine and with genomic sequencing as part of that, as well as telemedicine. These are world-class things that these two institutions have. Incredible untapped resources. It could be not just serving the state, and they should first and foremost serve the state, but also taking this technology to the rest of the world. And we're good at it. We're very good at it. We're world class.
One of the things that comes to mind too while we discuss these issues is that this is really an effort to work across the aisle with other members of the legislature and just people throughout South Dakota in general. Talk about working across the aisle and your interest in that and how that helps what we're talking about here in attracting these international dollars.
Well, I don't think anyone in the legislature disagrees with my emphasis on bringing new business in and preserving South Dakota's agricultural heritage. I think they agree on that. Those are the points I've worked on. So I have had very good luck of working across the aisle with these kinds of concepts. And I'm working with, for example, Representative Skylar Borglum, and I have begun to collaborate on an interesting project looking at the Pierce Shale formation that we have in South Dakota. It's not Bakken, but it is shale, and it could be producing more energy on a local level to decrease costs of energy. For example, you have a lot of that big formation under the Rosebud Indian Reservation. They could be utilizing or looking at utilizing that. And these are the kinds of things that are very agreeable across the aisle. So I'm concentrating on that, going back to my concept. New business, new ideas, thinking out of the box, and preserving South Dakota's agricultural heritage. Very important.
What's your assessment of Mexico as a trade partner with a focus on possibilities for South Dakota?
Well, Mexico is America's second largest international trade partner after Canada. And, we can just take trucks and drive things across the border, so it's very easy to export. The potential is tremendous. And we have a resource here. We have people that have come from Mexico, that have immigrated to South Dakota, come from Latin America, are Spanish-speaking. They're a great resource for helping us to move into those international marketplaces. So we should look at our immigrants and how what they can help provide us. And that's true of other immigrants also that can lead us into international business operations.
Right. Anything else you'd like to touch on, Michael, before we move on here today?
No, it's just that I think it's very important that all citizens become aware of the fact that we need to do more of this. They need to encourage the state to do more. We're one of only three states that did not get have any funds granted from the federal government, the SBA, for international trade missions. We didn't even apply. Hmm. Now we've got to be aware of that, and that the awareness comes from citizens saying, "Hey, you legislators, push the state government to do more of this. Don't just let them sit there and wait for this to come to us. We need to make it happen."
A lawyer for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe says the Keystone XL pipeline presents the same threats to Indian country as did wagon trains and the Transcontinental Railroad. Rosebud and the Fort Belknap Indian community have sued President Donald J. Trump for violating treaties when he issued a permit for the pipeline earlier this year. A hearing on the issue has been set in Montana federal court for September 12th. SDPB's Victoria Wicks has this report.
A lawyer representing the tribes wrote in pre-hearing briefs that this case is about enforcing the Fort Laramie Treaties of 1851 and 1868. Wes Furlong is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. He writes that those treaties ensured an end to tribal resistance to settlers. In exchange, the United States agreed, among other things, that immigrants would stop polluting the water, depleting game, and destroying the terrain as they built railroads and traveled the Oregon Trail.
Settlers were coming west. They were killing game. They were killing the buffalo. They were out-competing the tribes, and they were forcing them off land that they had historically been on for generations.
Furlong says construction of the Keystone XL pipeline threatens Indian country in the same way.
The potential of leaks and ruptures of the pipeline will have impacts on their water, on their land, on their other treaty-reserved resources for hunting and fishing, their ability to access game and fish.
In their lawsuit, the tribes allege that President Trump violated the U.S. promise of protection from encroachment and depredation when he agreed to the border crossing and potentially opened the door to environmental and cultural damage.
The tribes certainly view that as just a modern manifestation of the wagon train and settlers heading west.
In his briefs, Furlong relies in part on this year's U.S. Supreme Court opinion that upheld certain aspects of the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. TC Energy replied in briefs that the presidential permit allows passage into the United States for only 1.2 miles at the border. After that, the pipeline relies on permits from other federal, state, and local agencies. And so the president's action has no effect on Indian country. TC Energy did not respond to an invitation to comment.
South Dakota parents, educators, and health officials are facing a four-year gap in data about risky youth behaviors related to drinking and drug use, sexual activity, and eating habits. The reduced participation means that for the first time in nearly 30 years, data collected from the anonymous youth risk behavior surveys taken by South Dakota high school students was not considered valid, owing to low participation rates among schools. I asked Dr. Joshua Clayton, the South Dakota State Epidemiologist, exactly why it matters. So I want to talk about this idea of what's missing and how do we use that data. Now, what does the gap mean? What's at stake here with not having the data on risky youth behaviors for a certain, pretty extensive period of time, really?
Yeah. So, one of the important things that we have seen kind of arise in the past year has been the use of e-cigarettes among the youth population. It was such a strong issue that the Surgeon General issued an advisory on e-cigarette use among health in December of 2018. And part of what had been the focus or been the reasoning behind issuing that advisory is one of the surveys that they use at the national level looked at an increase of about 78% of current e-cigarette users between 2017 and 2018. So it jumped from about 11.7% to 20.8%, which is a dramatic increase. And one of the surveys that we use in South Dakota to monitor that sort of e-cigarette use is the YRBS. And since we're only asking it every other year, we now have that gap of about 4 years.
What would we do with the data if we had it?
So the most important thing is just realizing that, monitoring what's going on within our high school population, that information is relayed with a lot of partners out in the community, that information is relayed back to the schools so that they can make informed decisions that will hopefully decrease use within that population. So it might be focusing on tougher punishments for youth that are bringing e-cigarettes to school, or it might be identifying what resources are available within the community and making sure that there's we're able to connect teens that might be using those e-cigarettes with services such as the South Dakota Quit Line to help get them off of those e-cigarettes.
Dr. Ariel Sala is a Sanford Health researcher. She studies adolescent addiction and the use of e-cigarettes and vaping products. We talked about why data matters and her insights into e-cigarette usage might surprise you.
So the main difference between conventional cigarettes and e-cigarette usage is that conventional cigarettes are combustible. It burns the elements and then you inhale them. But anything related to e-cigarettes electronically heats the elements, so you don't have that combustible element. So things like Juuls qualify as e-cigarettes, and there's so many new brand names and product types. But the commonality when I speak of e-cigarettes is that it electronically heats the elements, so it's more of a vapor instead of
still
combustible.
Tobacco.
It's nicotine. It's not nicotine. Necessarily tobacco.
Okay.
So it's kind of synthetically derived nicotine.
And it can be flavored. How come? Because cigarettes, the conventional cigarettes are not, they're tobacco flavored.
Right. So with conventional cigarettes, they're either tobacco flavored. In some cases, menthol is the only flavor exception. And that, I guess, got grandfathered in under some of the regulations. So conventional cigarettes are not allowed to have flavors. E-cigarettes are a different product because they're not derived from tobacco directly. They're nicotine, but they're not tobacco. Then they are able to get around some of those regulations and have flavors.
Okay, so the criticism is, of course, by getting around those regulations, they're creating flavors like gummy bear and French toast and hot chocolate or, whatever, bubble gum, which is, people are saying, directly targeted toward kids. So are we seeing a lot of, what has your data shown about how many kids are drawn to e-cigarettes, and what are some of the limitations of what we know right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that is the concern out there from the mainstream public health community, that e-cigarettes are being advertised towards kids with all these flavors, these candy flavors, with cartoons on the packaging and so forth. And so they are perhaps being targeted towards kids. However, my data don't really back up that we're drawing in new populations of users. So some of the limitations of the data are, and without getting into the nitty-gritty statistically, it's really difficult to be able to tell whether e-cigarettes have their own effect or whether those kids were going to use conventional tobacco products anyway if e-cigarettes had not been on the market. So some of the things that we can look at are what are the risk factors of kids that use e-cigarettes versus conventional cigarettes versus kids that never use either product. And when you look at sociodemographic factors, when you look at the history of family tobacco use and the peer group tobacco use, when you look at mental health issues, the kids that use e-cigarettes look a lot more similar on all of these factors to the conventional cigarette users than either of them do to the non-users. So we're kind of comparing apples and oranges when we compare non-users and e-cigarette users and then look at what they go on to do later with
tobacco.
So
let's talk about addiction in the sense that how do you know that you're addicted to nicotine? Are these products as addictive as a conventional cigarette? How do you even measure a nicotine addiction?
That's a really good question. There is no blood test that you can do for nicotine addiction. It's again based on self-report, and there are better ways of asking it and worse ways of asking it. And there's a lot of researchers out there that devote their entire careers to validating some of these measurement scales and making sure that if I ask you a question on nicotine dependence, that it's really capturing the addiction aspect of nicotine dependence. So there's a couple of really rigorously measured scales out there, but they are based on self-report. So for example, one of the common items for nicotine dependence is how soon do you smoke when you wake up in the morning? And if it's within 5 minutes, then that's considered the most highly nicotine dependent answer, as opposed to the other extreme, which is more than 1 hour after waking up. So there's questions like that that are self-report, but there are rigorous ways of asking it. However, a lot of the existing research has been developed using these scales on conventional cigarettes, and it's not clear whether the same questions really apply and measure nicotine dependence in the same way to some of the newer products. So that's an active area of research right now, is to figure out how exactly do we measure nicotine dependence via self-report for e-cigarettes.
Right. And so what are you learning so far, or are you looking into this notion of it's a gateway to tobacco, to a conventional cigarette? Because that's an important question.
It is an important question, yes.
For a number of reasons. But first, before we get into those reasons, what are you finding about that?
So let me first say that I did buy into this. I did believe the gateway hypothesis when I first started researching. And I had my mind changed by the data that I looked at. And the data that I have a couple of studies out now that examine the gateway hypothesis. And I don't find any evidence for it. All of my research points to what in my field is called the common liability hypothesis, which is that there's a set proportion of the population that is bound to use one nicotine product or another, and they're more moving towards e-cigarette use and away from conventional tobacco use right now. So it's the same percentage of the population that uses tobacco. They're just using a different product now. So in other words, anybody that tries e-cigarettes was probably going to use conventional cigarettes anyway. And we certainly don't want to encourage e-cigarette use among youth, but let's be honest about it and say that kids are going to get their hands on some tobacco product, and we might as well make it e-cigarettes because those are estimated to have only 5% of the harmful effects of conventional cigarettes.
So that changes policy. It might change conversation around your kitchen table, might not. I'm not sure. That's up to parents. But it definitely would have an impact on some of the policy and regulations, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So I think there's a knee-jerk reaction in a lot of places now to regulate e-cigarettes as heavily as conventional cigarettes are being regulated. And that, in my estimation, is sort of premature in a lot of cases. And why does it matter? You might say, well, you know, we don't want kids to use e-cigarettes anyway, so what's the harm in banning flavors or banning advertisement to kids? The harm actually, and this is a study that's not mine, but it was a very interesting study I came across in the literature that found that states that passed e-cigarette legislation, it actually had the unintended effect of driving kids back towards conventional cigarettes. So if we want to think about the overall public health picture and the harm reduction, I think e-cigarettes are a safer alternative.
Is it, when we talk about that conversation, that kitchen table conversation, though, what are some of the harms of e-cigarettes? I mean, if we're not going to say, you know, if the kid's going to come to the table and say, hey, at least it's not a regular cigarette, you know, for a parent who does smoke, mm-hmm. that might be an effective starting point for the conversation. But for somebody who doesn't and doesn't want their kids anywhere near any of these products, what are some of the risks of the e-cigarettes and the vaping products?
So they are not completely safe. They still have things like formaldehydes and other carcinogens in it, although the levels are far below that of conventional cigarettes. The nicotine itself is a problem, and one of the problems that I see in e-cigarettes, if they are a gateway, which is, I think, yet to be established, one of the problems, I think, is that most kids don't realize that they have nicotine in them. So that's a problem, because then you get addicted to nicotine without even realizing what you're getting into. Mm-hmm. And nicotine does have a direct effect on cardiovascular health. So that could be a potential concern.
Lung problems? Are we seeing some, you know, we're starting to see these rumblings of kids with sort of catastrophic lung issues, and people are saying, is this connected to these products? What do you know about that?
Yeah, I'm not going to comment too much on that case, because I think it's unclear whether or not the e-cigarettes are directly responsible for that. But I will say, as far as the long-term health effects, we really don't have the data yet, so it's very hard to say. What we can do in the moment while we collect data is we can say, we can measure their exposure to nicotine and their exposure to other toxins in the products, and maybe compare them to conventional cigarettes and then to non-users on the other hand. Mm. And we can kind of estimate what the health effects might be, but we actually won't really know for decades, unfortunately, because the data are just coming out on use, and we have to track these people. Like, we don't have any data right now on what somebody looks like after a lifetime of e-cigarette use. We just don't have that data yet.
That makes me uncomfortable. I don't You mentioned something I want to go back to, which is the risk factors, cigarette usage in the home, and you mentioned mental health. And let's talk a little bit about early addiction, nicotine addiction or other addiction, and how it intersects with anxiety and depression and things like that in kids especially.
Yes. So those with anxiety and depression are much more likely to use substances, which include tobacco. So there's a huge comorbidity here. There's a huge overlap between substance use and mental health issues. And it goes beyond just anxiety and depression. Something like 80% of people with schizophrenia are smokers, and this is thought to result from maybe self-medicating their symptoms. And so this could happen in a lot of other mental health issues as well.
So I know someone who smokes, and he said, "This is my least dangerous addiction, so lay off." So when you talk to people about, about that addiction, and especially I'm thinking of parents when they're trying to figure out, we're not research scientists, we're parents, we're trying to do what's right for our kids. You could make the assumption here that this is a fairly harmless activity.
I would say so. I think we never want to encourage adolescents to go out and try e-cigarettes or any other substance. But I think we should be realistic about the fact that many of them are going to try it. And from that, given that assumption, I think we should think about harm reduction. And I think e-cigarettes are fairly safe compared to many of the other products out there.
How does, and we only have like a minute left, so this is going to, you're probably going to get excited about this question that I'm going to say, we're out of time. Machine learning and artificial intelligence in your job, the information that's coming in and the new ways we have of analyzing it, how is that changing this kind of research for you?
It's changing it a lot. I do a lot of machine learning in my studies and big data analysis, and it's really helped us to move away from a one-size-fits-all approach to more targeted interventions and, how do we identify the kids that are at risk? And then how do we treat them once we've identified the ones that are at risk? What kind of intervention can we do with them? And how is that particular to their circumstances based on their data and compared to the larger population?
You're pretty optimistic about how your job is going to change even in the next 5 years.
I'm excited about it. It's changing, but that's always a good thing for me because changes mean that we need to understand what's going on.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is announcing hemp crop insurance coverage for the year 2020. The chair of the South Dakota State Legislative Summer Study looking into industrial hemp in the state says that's a big deal for South Dakota farmers who want to grow hemp. However, the announcement doesn't change Governor Kristi Noem's opposition to industrial hemp legalization, SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Governor Noem says her position on hemp is a principled policy stand. She says legalizing industrial hemp weakens drug laws in South Dakota. She says it would legalize marijuana, hemp's cousin in the cannabis family, because law enforcement officials are unable to distinguish between the two. Noem says ultimately industrial hemp would strain local prosecutors financially to the point of no longer prosecuting marijuana cases and threaten the health and safety of the next generation. Republican Representative Lee Qualm is chair of the Industrial Hemp Legislative Study. He says he's excited the USDA has come up with a coverage plan. He says that will give farmers a feeling there's a safety net they can work with.
There's always that concern. Are farmers going to have to stand the risk all by themselves? A brand new crop, you know, the markets are just getting going. I mean, the CBD oil, that's going pretty good. But as far as the fiber, the seed, you know, we got to get some markets developed for that. And so this helps us feel a little more comfortable.
Legislators are anxiously awaiting federal guidelines for industrial hemp cultivation as well. Qualm says he expects USDA rules around industrial hemp to arrive around the end of September or the first part of October. He says those will help the committee.
You know, then we've kind of got some parameters to make it easier to establish our rules.
The next industrial hemp study meeting is October 7th.
Two Democrats have announced their intentions to run for South Dakota's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in 2020. U.S. GOP Senate candidate Skylar Borglum has a plan to take on the national debt, and posters for the American Identity Movement show up around the USD campus in Vermilion. All that on the Dakota Political Junkies shortlist for this week's discussion. Joining us, Mike Card, Associate Professor of Political Science at USD, along with Jonathan Ellis, investigative reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. So, Jonathan, let's start with this the South Dakota Democratic Party and an audit, and the story's going to kind of unfold a little bit as we go. But before we do that, Jonathan, help us go back to the 2016 election and tell us there's some financial decisions that are problematic that are being looked at in an audit. What's going on here? How did this begin?
Well, it began, South Dakota's Democratic State Party was one of probably about three dozen or so that were used to sort of as pass-throughs between the Hillary Clinton campaign and then the national the DNC in order to bypass, skirt campaign finance spending limits. And so South Dakota, of course, has been one of the states, the party's been one of the states audited on that. And I think they found roughly about $2.5 million that had been passed through the state party then to skirt these campaign finance rules. You know, it was interesting at the time, and I haven't looked at these reports in a while, but looking at them maybe a couple of years ago, that you saw kind of very odd kind of donations coming into the state party, and then you saw the state party then sending out money. But, I mean, you know, very odd donations from people in, you know, New York and California, and just play, you're thinking, why would these people be donating money to the state, you know, the South Dakota Democratic Party? So anyway, the Democrats, and I think that there are some allegations the Republicans will also use the same loophole, you know, found a loophole and were able to kind of bypass campaign finance spending limits. The audit has not been finalized because the FEC, which conducted the audit, doesn't currently necessarily have a quorum of commissioners who can vote to approve the final audit. So it remains kind of in limbo right now to see, you know, how that will ultimately shake out.
All right, so when you say the money has passed through, none of it landed in a Democratic candidate in South Dakota. You know, they weren't used in the state at all. It was just plain from one place to another. Is that what the indication is?
I can't say that definitively,
right.
Hence
the audit, right?
Yeah, the vast majority of it would have been used as a pass-through, correct.
So, Mike Card, tell us, is this, Jonathan used the word loophole, so is it legal, is it not legal, what's going on here?
Well, generally a loophole is viewed as something that's legal but fails the smell test in some senses. You know, you're able to donate to a larger organization that has multiple candidates signed up to be members, and you can distribute the money equally among them. That's legal.
And the smell test, Mike.
Well, I think the smell test is, well, boy, that's a lot of money. And it's not all, we don't like money coming in from out of state. I don't think any state likes money coming in from out of state to influence its elections. And that draws people's attention, and not in a positive light.
So, Mike, this notion of, you know, we have the Republican Party, Dan Lederman, saying, you know, we told you so. We knew this was sort of fishy from the beginning. We have Paula Hawks, who's in charge of the Democratic Party, saying, yeah, there was a lack of oversight. Let's talk a little bit about the response from local party leaders as, you know, the audit process stalls? How are people sort of, you know, spinning it in a way? Mike, let's start with you, and then we'll ask Jonathan the same question.
Well, that is an interesting question. The spin that I've seen is we didn't pay enough attention. You know, the nicer way to say that is there was a lack of oversight. Anything put in passive voice hides the actor. The counter view is you weren't paying attention, and I think that's where we're at with the lack of reporting.
Yeah.
And often, you know, we haven't heard from the individual involved with the accounting, or I haven't seen it. Perhaps it's been in one of the other newspapers, but we haven't heard from the person who actually did the reporting, and I haven't been able to find the actual reports itself, but I haven't looked very hard.
Jonathan, what are your thoughts on really what needs to be said for, and how is it going to be used by the Republican Party in the state? Clearly, nationwide, the Republicans are having the same problem, but not necessarily in South Dakota. And how are the Democrats kind of handling this whole thing as it unfolds in the state?
Well, I mean, certainly the current leader is trying to shift blame to the past leader. And the Republicans are saying, you know, I told you so. The Republicans have been talking about this actually for quite a while. I mean, they were looking at, again, all of these kind of weird campaign irregularities with money coming in from all sorts of weird places. And then, you know, so they've been, this is not new to them. And obviously this audit's been ongoing for a while. So of course, you know, you try to use it as political advantage. You try to paint the party as, you know, it's kind of unseemly and corrupt, and that's, you know, simply that's what you do in politics. You know, I think the broader takeaway is that campaign finance laws are really just, you know, campaign money in politics is like water. It's going to go somewhere. It's going to find the place of least resistance. And so, I can remember when McCain-Feingold placed really severe limitations on what political parties could raise, and suddenly you had, you know, so you change the scope of campaigns. Suddenly the Democrats actually were very good at seizing on a new way to get money into politics through 527 groups. And so it's always this kind of escalation of where can you find the path of least resistance to get money into politics. And so I think these laws like McCain-Feingold and all of the laws, they're well-intentioned, I suppose, in terms of people trying to limit abuse of money in politics. But at the end of the day, they never really seem to be all that successful.
So as Jonathan mentioned, the Federal Elections Commissioner, Matthew Peterson, is resigning, which means they don't have a quorum, which means this whole audit process is sort of in limbo, and it doesn't move forward. You know, do you anticipate them challenging each other to, you know, to make a commitment not to do this, even though it's possibly a legal sort of action? Does it come into play in the conversation, or does it just kind of quietly go away as people say, you know, we're not going to do that anymore, but we're not going to talk about it either?
Well, I think it depends upon what other issues there are to raise. You know, in a sense, we've got a fight, and in a fight, almost no holds are barred, so to speak. And I would expect that if no issues seem to come up, we will hear more about this from the Republican Party. And if there are issues to bring up, we're going to see both parties blame each other. One would be from a national perspective, and the other one would be at a state perspective. The money will find the candidates. And there are very good lawyers and experienced lawyers in campaign and campaign finance who will find that loophole, that opening. You know, we say a loophole giving it a bad idea, but a loophole is simply an opening in the law that allows for, in this case, investment. And the key here is whose voice are we hearing?
Mm, interesting. All right, so let's talk about some of those candidates looking to be a landing spot for some of that money, because we have some new faces in the races. And last week, I believe, the conversation was in anticipation. We've got some announcements and more details. We've got some Democrats, Jonathan Ellis, who have decided to challenge U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson for the state's only seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. What do we know about these folks, an East River candidate and a West River candidate?
Yeah, one of them is, well, they both are share in common that they have run for office, legislator, a lot of the legislature, and were not successful, but so they do have a little political experience, and Brian Worth is from Del Rapids, and then you've got Whitney Raver, who's from the West River. So, you know, that's the start. I mean, and they're both running for House, so presumably they would be a primary, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are additional candidates in that race.
So we should point out Whitney Raver of Custer has not technically announced yet she's planning on, but she's confirmed that she's running, but she hasn't done that formal announcement. Now, Skylar Borglum has done that formal announcement, and she's intending to run against Mike Rounds. She's a Republican, and now she's bringing some policy stuff forward. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about this focus on national debt is something she's kind of going after the Republicans now and saying we can do better as Republicans to reduce that. What's her plan, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, what, is this, circa 2014 where you have a Republican talking about the national debt, but since winning the presidency, I think you recall in the 8 years of the Barack Obama presidency that Republicans frequently talked about deficits and the national debt, and then all of a sudden we don't hear about that very much anymore from the Republican Party. So here we have, I think, Skylar Borglum. I do think that there are a number of Republicans out there who are very concerned about the national debt, and so this is potentially an issue that could have some traction with voters, but she says that they need to start doing something about the $22 trillion debt. I think she's proposed, it's kind of interesting, she's proposed that if a budget were to exceed the 5% of the previous year's discretionary budget, that it would go to a national vote, which that's kind of an interesting take on a representative democracy there. But, it's something certainly different, and it's certainly... Again, I think a lot of conservatives in this state look at that national debt and really kind of get worried about that.
Yeah. The national debt is impacted by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but she's also has this plan to sort of say there's an innovative way to get around it, which is sort of triggering this national vote component. She wants to take a little of the power away from Congress. Mike, what do you think? Is that a good way to run for Congress? Is to make the promise? Who it kind of reminds me of is Tim Bjorkman, who when he was running was talking about the sort of drastic changes he would make to kind of dial back the dialing for dollars. Didn't get very far with that, although it was a really important to him, during the campaign.
Well, the dialing for dollars in the campaign finance is a different issue,
right? Yes.
Related to our first part of the conversation, a populist perspective, and that is the idea that we should let the people vote on whether we're going to increase our debt in a given year or the amount of money that we're borrowing that's above and beyond the revenues coming in. That's just odd for certainly this. What we've seen coming out of the South Dakota legislature, if they're representative of the people's will. So it's an interesting idea to take money away from, take the power away from Congress to do that, and to do so with a national referendum. I suspect that would require a constitutional amendment, but I'm not a constitutional law scholar.
Well, we'll talk more about that in the future. And I want to make sure we get to what's happening. School has started. The students are back at college. We're talking with Mike Carr down in USD, and one of the first things that people are talking about is these posters from the American Identity Movement, which have showed up on the University of South Dakota campus. Tell us, Mike, a little bit about what you know about these posters appearing on campus and who they're from.
Well, they're from an organization called the American Identity Movement, and its initials are AIM, and I'm old enough to remember when AIM meant something very different in the state of South Dakota. And I thought, wow, the American Indian Movement is putting up, membership posters. Right. And then I started looking more closely at these and realized, no, this really isn't the American Indian Movement. I don't know if there was an intention in that, or it was just the national branding of the organization to really focus on identity. And it appears that they are an organization. I haven't seen any students, and the students I talked with yesterday and this morning, none of them know anyone who put up a poster, which is really odd. They usually have a pretty good network. But there were posters, I think 8 in total that I saw, not in total, but 8 different posters in many of the bulletin boards. There aren't things up yet, so they were quite a bit of attention. There were so many posters around that they were lying in the floors and on wastebaskets and in chairs. Somebody put some real money into this. These are 8.5 by 11 inch posters that show largely workers, you know, protect American workers seems to be the message, as well as not being supportive of diversity. I don't know how better to say that. Because, you know, diversity ends nations or something like that was one of the posters.
Diversity destroys nations is the language that I'm seeing. Jonathan, this American Identity Movement is really a rebranding of another organization. They're looking to sort of refresh their marketing message to recruit college students. Tell us a little bit more about what they're after by, a poster distribution at a university.
Well, yeah, I mean, from what the Volant was reporting, I mean, they are trying to recruit some college students, trying to recruit. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the diversity is kind of at the heart of our university system. I mean, it's very instilled, I think, in students and the importance of diversity and things like that. So they're kind of at the heart of where a lot of efforts at fostering diversity are found. You know, and I thought it was interesting too that that the founder of this group told the Volant that this is, you know, they're a nonviolent group. They reject all political violence and racial supremacy, which I thought was interesting. So, we've had some in the wake of some very fairly violent acts by people who are white nationalists. So I thought that was kind of an interesting take on it. But yeah, they are trying to recruit students in what it would be sort of the heart of efforts to foster diversity in the United States in the university system.
This is a group that helped organize the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, and some of their messages back and forth have been leaked, talking about mass deportations and segregation and Holocaust denial. So this is part of a rebranding effort, as I said, Mike, to sort of make the organization a little more palatable to mainstream college students. I guess I don't know who exactly to get media coverage like the conversation that we're having right now, perhaps. Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think they also have posterized Augustana University in Sioux Falls, and it'll be interesting to see where else they go. Mm-hmm. You know, this is part of the social contract that, in essence, organizations like this are trying to put forward a message so that they can attract members. We don't always pay attention to all of the messages or the implications of the messages that people are sending, but, you know, it's about what rights do we have as individuals, and as social contract is what rights are we willing to give up to the government so that we can maintain other rights that are important to us. And in this case, it's, you know, should we have more open borders or diversity is specifically the case. It's interesting to me that this is just an idea that we have to have engagement of conversation that we hope is civil. We're governed by a board of regents who spend a lot of time examining whether our free speech rights on universities are discriminatory or whether we're allowing an open discussion of ideas. Hmm. And I know that some of the posters were taken down because in certain places at the university, you have to have the posters be date stamped. And that's so that we know when we can take things down rather than have someone come along and take down all posters so that they can put theirs up. Mm-hmm. And that's usually in the university union area. But
you have to obey the poster policy.
Yeah. I mean, you have to. There's certain rules that apply to everybody, no matter what your perspective is.
Right.
And in order to have free speech, we allow free speech.
So South Dakota is joining 14 other states in a case the United States Supreme Court will hear regarding discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. The brief the state joined says discrimination based on sex does not include those two. Civil rights groups disagree. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has the story.
Three companion cases will get heard by the nation's high court on three individuals who say they've been fired for being LGBTQ. No one from Attorney General Jason Ramsburg's office was available for comment. In an email, Chief of Staff Tim Borman says the office joins other states on amicus filings on a regular basis. Borman goes on to say the crux of the case is sex defined by Congress in 1964, not on sexual orientation. Libby Screen is the policy director for the South Dakota ACLU. She says it's disappointing the state joined the brief when it didn't have to.
Courts across this country have repeatedly issued rulings saying that discriminating against someone because they are LGBT is a form of sex discrimination because it relies on sex stereotyping. There is a very long line of cases that have found that. So to argue that we should go back to, you know, the 1960s definition is really problematic.
Both the Second and Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals say the term sex extends to orientation. Two of the employees in the case are ACLU clients and argue that one was fired for being transgender while another was fired for being gay. The case is the first transgender civil rights case to get heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. Arguments are set for October 8th.
Human Relations Task Force has been appointed in Rapid City. Their job? Analyze the Human Relations Commission. That's a group that was established more than 10 years ago to focus on resolving discrimination issues in the city. That task force will determine whether the commission needs to be reformed or shut down. SDPB's China Lockett reports.
Rapid City Mayor Steve Allender picked six people to participate in the task force. There are a mix of political affiliations, races, and genders. Allender says there are problems with the way the commission operates.
Last fall, I did send a informal poll to the remaining task force members who kind of confirmed my suspicion that their hands were really tied in a lot of instances.
Allender says the commission and task force only cost a couple $1,000s for the city to run. Issues brought to the commission can be handled locally or are referred out to state or federal agencies. Allender says there's no need to double up on resources when different agencies are better equipped for certain issues.
I think what we need is something that's efficient and meaningful, something that people can see value from, and something that also won't create a false sense of hope or justice. And I think that's kind of what the old configuration of the commission was doing. It was giving people a place to go and complain about virtually anything as long as they felt they had been disrespected or discriminated against.
Allender chose members for the task force he says are objective, though some members are actively involved in addressing race relations in Rapid City. The task force's job is to identify a range of solutions for the commission.
To see if it should exist at all, or if it exists, what the scope should be, because I think it would be a mistake to pick up exactly where we've left off and have the same scope and the same intent and then put a whole nother group of people through the same frustrating process of not being able to do anything.
Allender hopes to take a fresh, honest look at the role of human relations in the city.
That's the news roundup for this week. Thanks for joining us. Are you looking for each individual segment from the In the Moment daily radio broadcast? Well, you can find them all on a new podcast, In the Moment Segments. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Twitter at MomentSDPB. Do you have a story idea for the show? Send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Chris Loffrey, Steve Swemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.